It is Wednesday, September 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urges warplanes to stop flying over Syria.
The future of Syria is hanging by a thread, and I urge this council not to give up.
We look at the history of recent presidential debates, and a new book explores the history of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told the United Nations Wednesday that all planes should be grounded in war-torn areas to protect the Syrian truce.
The future of Syria is hanging by a thread, and I urge this council not to give up, but instead to support the steps outlined by the United States and Russia in Geneva. And I call on every party in Syria and those who support them. I call on all members of the opposition to cooperate and revive this plan.
Kerry said he wanted to emphasize to Russia that Washington still supports finding a diplomatic solution. Meanwhile, an airstrike last night near Aleppo, Syria, killed at least four medical workers, employees of the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. The bombing occurred a day after an international aid convoy was hit by airstrikes, killing at least 20. The United States believes Russia is responsible for the attack, but Moscow has denied it. Dr. Kaula Sawa is the CEO of UOSSM USA. I asked her about what's known about the circumstances surrounding the airstrike that killed the healthcare workers.
Yesterday, about 10:30 or 11, probably around 10:30, our ambulance was dispatched to this. There was a medical emergency point in the southern part of Aleppo. We have ambulatory systems, or dispatches, want to call them, that are working in the area and also in the area of Idlib as well. And we work in partnership with WHO. Our ambulatory dispatch are usually called to the scenes of where, you know, there's bombing, or they're called to medical points to triage patients because they can't be treated in the area to be transferred to the hospital. So from our staff on the ground, they were dispatched, and two drivers, basically two ambulances, and you have two drivers for that, and three of our nurses was in those two ambulances. On the arrival, it looks like the medical point was airstrike, and we lost our four staff, including two drivers and two nurses. And the fifth one that was in critical condition was triaged to our hospital at the Syrian-Turkish border, Bab el Hawa Hospital, but it was in critical condition that was transferred to Turkey.
Is it known who was responsible for the airstrike?
We don't know. I mean, the airstrike was so severe. It looks like the medical point itself was three stories. And my understanding from the staff on the ground that two it was above the ground and one, you know, like a basement or underground. And because of the intensity of the strike, the whole building went down. But we don't know exactly who is responsible for the airstrike.
And I'm sure that area has been, you know, just hit so much just within the recent days and weeks.
Yes. And not only that area. In general, the Aleppo city, even from the western part of. So really the area, the whole Aleppo, I could say province area, from the south, from the north, from the west, have been targeted repeatedly within the last few months by airstrikes and barrels.
Well, those healthcare workers in that area, as well as the ambulance drivers, I mean, they must be incredibly brave people to be continuing to do this.
Yes, they are. I mean, these are selfless people. They are putting their lives at risk to save other people. And unfortunately, our four workers lost their lives to do that. So we're not responsible for the medical point itself, but our staff are being called to different areas, even to scene areas that has been recently bombed. They go to wherever they're being triaged to transfer injured civilians from one point to another. And usually if they get them from the scene or from medical points, because these are like basic, you know, treatment centers, usually they transfer them to more advanced hospitals in the area.
That's Dr. Kaula Sawa. She's the CEO of the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations, USA. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, there are two stories that are trending, two different police shootings here in the U.S., and we'll start with Terrence Crutcher in the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was shot and killed by police. They say he was trying to reach for a gun. His family's come out and said that there's no evidence of that that they've found. But the footage of his shooting death is quickly spreading across social media. We're seeing a lot of people share this, and we're seeing a lot of people weighing in on this case and another case, which is Keith Lamont Scott in the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, who was shot and killed by police. Now, in the case of Keith Lamont Scott, his daughter actually went on Facebook Live to explain what happened from her point of view or her understanding of the situation, to say that her father wasn't a bad man, he wasn't trying to do any harm to police when they shot and killed him. So we see this increasingly, people weighing in, family members even of these victims weighing in on social media and using that as a tool. We see others like sports stars and celebrities weighing in, including Steve Harvey, the comedian, who tweeted out, he said, "All we ask for is one thing, justice." And then with that Keith Lamont Scott shooting in Charlotte, North Carolina, we see a lot of protests as well. So we're seeing a lot of that footage on social media as some protests took place overnight in that city, roads being shut down, clashes between police officers and protesters. So we're seeing, sadly, these events happen on social media and captured on this video. We're seeing the reaction on video and social media, and then we're seeing the aftermath as well. So it's cataloging each step of this along the way. And my suspect, as we've seen in previous cases, that this is only going to continue as they play out.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. U.S. President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meet possibly for the last time, with the Middle East peace pact still elusive. India summons a Pakistani official over a deadly attack in Kashmir. The U.S. approves an Airbus deal with Iran, and Charlotte police brace for more protests after a fatal shooting. Expanded coverage of these stories are on voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international research team says their new analysis of 28 previously unidentifiable bone fragments gathered from an archaeological site in north-central France may have solved a long-running dispute. Some scientists argue that only modern humans have the cognitive ability to produce tools and artifacts such as body ornaments, also found at the French dig site. But the researchers claim their studies confirm that the items were actually produced by Neanderthals, a now extinct relative of modern humans. Their analysis indicates that the bone fragments are from the remains of a young and breastfed individual. Radiocarbon dating of the fragments indicates Neanderthal ancestry. Neanderthals were a hominid species that were said to have lived in Europe, Northern Africa, and Western Asia from about 30,000 to 200,000 years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll look at the construction of a castle in France using only historic tools. Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump face off in the first of a series of three presidential debates Monday in Hempstead, New York. Clinton and Trump are locked in a close race for the White House, and if history is any guide, the debates could have a significant impact on the election. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the history and significance of the presidential debates from Washington.
The first televised presidential debates were held in 1960 between Republican Vice President Richard Nixon and Democratic Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts.
We must give this country leadership, and we must get America moving again.
Kennedy's polished performance against the more experienced Nixon helped to shape the outcome of the election, which Kennedy narrowly won. It shows how presidential debates can be important, says expert Jeremy Mayer.
It establishes stature. If you can stand toe-to-toe and be the equal of somebody who's more well-known, That's one thing that happens in debates.
In the 1976 debates, President Gerald Ford hurt himself in his race with Democratic challenger Jimmy Carter with a gaffe on the influence of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe.
Carter pounced on Ford's mistake, and Ford wound up losing in a close race. Another example where the debates proved to be crucial, says Georgetown University's Stephen Wayne.
Presidential debates are important in presidential elections when the candidates are very close. Most of the people who watch the debates root for their side or for their candidate.
4 years later, Carter lost his bid for re-election when Republican Ronald Reagan outperformed him in their only debate.
Governor Reagan, again, typically is against such a proposal.
Governor, there you go again.
Reagan's closing question to voters has become a debate standard.
Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls. You'll stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
In more recent years, candidates were mostly concerned with not making any major mistakes in the debates, says Jeremy Mayer.
Debates seem to be getting a little less powerful. People aren't watching them as much as they used to. Now, that may be ameliorated by the fact that while people aren't watching them live, if you make a mistake, everybody watches a clip of it on Facebook or on YouTube.
Election analysts expect that the first Clinton-Trump debate could be the most watched event of the campaign, with enormous stakes for both contenders. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, if you really want to understand how something was done, do it yourself. Archaeologists and builders throughout the years have tried that technique as a way to understand how ancient civilians were able to construct megaliths like Stonehenge and wonders like the pyramids. Well, now a group of master builders in France is trying their hands at constructing a castle using only 13th century tools. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Long-handled wooden hammers and ancient chisels. These are some of the tools that a group of 40 master builders are using to construct a castle from scratch in central France. They've been at it since 1999.
On comprend maintenant le temps passé à construire un château, tout simplement.
We now understand the time taken to build a castle. It's extraordinary to see these men from back then who could build such a thing with the strength of their arms and their sweat. And in 10 years, it's extraordinary. The progression in 10 years is extraordinary.
Those behind the project, including volunteers like Nick Platt, hope building the castle will resolve unanswered questions over medieval construction.
I don't like using electric tools. Except perhaps drills. So when I came here, I found the use of hand tools was natural, but the saws that we use are very, very different, and were initially quite cumbersome to use, but now I find they're eminently perfect for the job.
Some of the ways they did things are familiar, and some are amazingly clever, like this treadmill crane that lifts rocks up to the higher stories of the castle. But they all require patience.
What is perhaps frustrating is that what we do takes a lot of time. In the modern world, we are used to working very quickly to being very competitive. And here, we want to focus on quality more than quantity. And you have to forget some of the pace of modern life to be able to adapt to working by hand here.
De travailler très rapidement, d'être compétitif, et ici on va faire de la qualité plus que de la quantité, et il faut oublier des certains rythmes modernes pour pouvoir s'adapter au travail à la main ici.
The project has become a tourist destination. So many visit that the project, which was initially funded by the European Union, is now entirely financed by the 300,000 tourists who visit the site each year. If you can't make it to Burgundy this year, don't worry. The builders expect to be at it for another 10 to 15 years. And that's just on the outside of the castle. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
Sounds like quite a project. This is VOA.
Democracy in Action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, with all the international problems plaguing the world, it's always a good idea to look at history. One dark day was the events that led to the end of World War II. Pearl Harbor. Newly uncovered information about what led to that is being released in a brand new book called Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. The author is historian Craig Nelson, who joined International Edition's Lori London. She said to him, it really has come now to be known as the day that will live in infamy.
Well, that's a great story, in fact. There was a tremendous squabble at that moment between the Japanese Army and Japanese Navy, who had been squabbling for the past three decades, where the Navy did not want to attack the United States without warning. So they decided that the Navy would, Foreign Office would present their final terms 30 minutes before the attack, and that that would be fair. Mm-hmm. However, the Army then changed the language of the message so that no one understood that this meant the start of war, and they delayed it so it came out an hour and a half after the attack. So that's how infamy began.
And your book really goes behind the scenes and talks to people, the remaining survivors, which is fascinating in and of itself.
What we found out was that the last really definitive history of Pearl Harbor was researched 50 years ago. And that was a book called At Dawn We Slept. And there's been so much that has come out since then, especially from the Japanese side, from Pearl Harbor survivors who couldn't talk because they were basically traumatized. They really couldn't discuss it for decades. And even stories of civilians who were there and Japanese Americans in Hawaii and the aftermath of Pearl Harbor meant in American history, that it's really almost like an entirely new book, an entirely new perspective. For example, there's a famous Torah, 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 which is the launch of the attack, which everyone has heard meant tiger, 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 and it was a secret code. But that's just a coincidence. It actually is two words, To and Ra, and it means for the torpedo planes to attack, and everyone in the Japanese Navy involved in the mission knew that meant that it was a complete surprise and that America had been caught totally unaware.
Given the political climate we are in right now, it's sort of an interesting contrast. I see here that you also talk about America's diplomatic blunders that contributed to Pearl Harbor's in the months leading up to the attacks.
Some of what we found seems very familiar to us with recent events because, for example, one thing that happened is that repeatedly the Army and the Navy told Roosevelt and his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, that Hawaii was impregnable, that Japan was physically incompetent race of people who couldn't possibly attack Oahu. There were 35,000 troops stationed there. They wouldn't think about it. They were much weaker than the United States. And they kept this up for months and months and months until, and what this led to was that Hull and Roosevelt were belligerent in negotiating with the Japanese. And we found that there were many moments where they could have negotiated a peace accord by figuring out a way for the Japanese to save face and exit from China, which was the big stumbling block. And we could have actually not had ever had a Pearl Harbor or a Pacific Theater. But because we'd been told by the Army and the Navy that things were so great, they took a very hard line. And then on November 5th, 1941, a little over a month before the attack, the Navy and the Army said, oh, wait a minute, actually, Japan is very powerful in the Pacific, and you need to play for time. And by then, it was too late.
Some of the stories of the remaining survivors and veterans, what was it like to talk to those folks?
Amazing stories to me are the people who were so horribly traumatized and we didn't know what PTSD was, and we told anybody who said something like that, we called them a coward, and when they all came back from World War II, they were told to just get on with their lives. And I really think a whole generation of Americans suffered from various traumas going through World War II, because even when you read the history of the battle of this attack, you don't really get how gruesome and horrible it really was until you get to the people who talk about it decades later. One incredible story to me is a man is at the beach with his child, and this is almost 10 years after Pearl Harbor, and he's at the beach with his little toddler son, and a wave comes up, a rogue wave comes up and sweeps the little boy out into the water. And the man starts running towards the water to rescue him, and he freezes dead in his tracks and can't go in the ocean because he had spent, he was 18 years old, and he had spent Pearl Harbor swimming through the water, which was on fire and filled with floating dead bodies, to try and rescue injured but living people. And he was so lucky during that beach incident because he had a military dog that had become their pet, and the dog rescued the child out of the water. But that man was never able to even walk near a beach again. He had been so traumatized.
That's author and historian Craig Nelson. His new book is called Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, and he spoke with International Edition's Lori London. Well, Americans are getting ready to elect their president for the coming 4 years. An auction at Christie's in New York brings memories of the 40th president and first lady. The auction is called The Private Collection of President and Mrs. Ronald Reagan and includes more than 700 items. Many of these things went with the Reagans from California to the White House and then returned to California again. Jonathan Rundell, deputy chairman of Christie's America, says it's the very private side of a very public life. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For a while, it looked like the 2.5-year-old civil war in South Sudan might finally be over. In August of last year, both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar signed a peace agreement to end the conflict, the terms of which confirmed Salva Kiir as president and returned Riek Machar to government as the first vice president. But just months after Riek Machar returned to South Sudan to resume his vice presidential duties, violence resumed and Machar fled. One of the most heinous aspects of South Sudan's civil war is the forced conscription of child soldiers, children younger than 18, with far too many under the age of 15. According to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Agency, since South Sudan's civil war began in December 2013, over 16,000 children have been recruited into armed groups on both sides. UNICEF has reported on the recruitment of child soldiers since the July 7th outbreak of violence. Both sides are using various methods, including coercion and blackmail, to force parents to surrender their children to them. The United States is profoundly alarmed by the UNICEF report. Above and beyond our calls for an end to ongoing violence in South Sudan, we insist on an immediate halt to the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers by government and opposition forces. Individuals responsible for the unlawful recruitment or use of child soldiers for armed groups or forces may be subject to sanction under U.S. law and may be targeted for U.N. sanctions, said State Department spokesman John Kirby in a written statement. The continued unlawful recruitment and use of children in armed conflict in South Sudan is unacceptable. Eliminating the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers for armed groups in South Sudan is a leading priority of the United States. We remain committed to securing accountability for those who recruit and use children as soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.